Right, what I'm going to do now is, I don't want to start papers that, well, I want to do papers 2 to 4 as a block, and I want to do paper 1 with enough time to make sure that it gets its form produced. So with that in mind, what I will do now, I think, given we're a little ahead of schedule, is bring forward one of the shorter papers. So I think we'll bring forward paper 8, looking at what you do where you've got something with a maturity of less than 12 months. So is that you, Benedict?
Yeah.
Okay, so agenda paper 8, if you can all leaf through. Sorry to disrupt your running order.
I'll slow so I can wipe my notes.
Right, so agenda paper 8 addresses a question regarding the requirement to assess for significant increases in credit risk for assets with a maturity of less than 12 months. And so the submitter notes that IFRS 9 neither requires or permits an entity to always measure the loss allowance at an amount equal to the lifetime expected credit losses for financial assets originated with a term of 12 months or less, unless they otherwise fall within one of the exceptions to the general model. And one such example of those exceptions is set out in paragraph 5515A, part 1 of IFRS 9, and that relates to short-term trade receivables and contract assets in the scope of IFRS 15. And the submitter makes the point that for financial assets with a maturity of less than 12 months, the 12-month and lifetime expected credit loss allowance will be the same, and therefore monitoring whether there has been a significant increase in credit risk in respect of these assets won't be relevant for the purposes of measurement in terms of the expected credit losses. But the submitter also observes that IFRS 7 does require disclosures that distinguish between financial instruments for which the loss allowance is equal to 12-month or lifetime expected credit losses, so that distinction is made clear. So the submitter questions whether it's necessary then to assess for significant increases in credit risk for these types of financial assets, so where the 12-month and lifetime expected credit losses are the same due to the maturity. And there are two separate views presented, the first being that it is necessary to continue to assess for significant increases in credit risk. And in support of that view, the submitter observes that the disclosures in paragraph 35M of IFRS 7 are required in order to provide users with information about the credit quality of financial instruments and to make the distinguishment between the financial instruments which have suffered a significant increase in credit risk and those which have not. And therefore, irrespective of the term to maturity of the asset, this disclosure is useful information to understand an entity's exposure to credit risk. And then the alternative view put forward is that it's not necessary to assess for significant increases in credit risk. And in support of that view, the submitter observes that the disclosures, in particular in paragraph 35H of IFRS 7, are there to provide users with information about the changes in loss allowance. And because there is no change in the loss allowance, no difference between the 12-month and lifetime expected credit loss allowance for these types of assets, that analysis simply isn't relevant. And the submitter instead suggests that perhaps you could show the short-term financial assets separately in order to distinguish them in a separate line. And you could also do a similar approach when looking at the requirements of paragraph 35M. Of IFRS 7 in terms of credit risk. And in the submitter's view, they also note that this would also be consistent with the approach that is taken for short-term trade receivables, which are one of those exceptions to the general rule that I mentioned in the opening paragraph. And so in our analysis of this issue, we noted that, again, as the submitter points out, unless a more specific exception applies, paragraphs 553 and 555 of IFRS 9 do require an entity to measure either 12-month or lifetime expected credit losses, depending on whether or not there has been a significant increase in credit risk, and that there is no specific exception for financial assets that have a maturity of less than 12 months unless they otherwise fell into one of the stated exceptions. And we also noted that in accordance with paragraph 559 of IFRS 9, the assessment of significant increases in credit risk focuses not on the changes in amount of expected credit loss, but on the risk of default carrying over the expected life. And that requirement highlights that the model in IFRS 9 does aim to distinguish between those financial instruments which have suffered that significant increase in credit risk and those which have not, irrespective of whether or not the expected credit loss amount has changed. And therefore, consistent with that principle, we have the corresponding disclosure requirements in IFRS 7 in 35H and 35M that also require this distinction between the financial instruments for which the loss allowance is measured at 12-month or lifetime expected credit losses. And the only exceptions in IFRS 9 are directly related to those exceptions in, so the exceptions in IFRS 7 for those disclosure requirements are only related to instances where there is an exception in IFRS 9 already, which either requires or permits an entity to always measure the loss allowance at an amount equal to lifetime expected credit losses. And overall, then, we would conclude that it would the entity would be required to continue to make the assessment of significant increases in credit risk, and that it wouldn't be appropriate to analogise to the specific exceptions, such as those set out in paragraph 5.5.15 and the related exceptions to the disclosure requirements in IFRS 7. So that's the agenda paper 8. So if anyone has any comments?
Paul? Yeah, I'll comment on this. I think I support the comments that the staff had made. I think it, in terms of looking at it, it does seem fairly straightforward in terms of the conclusion that you come to, as the staff have pointed out. I think both in terms of just looking at the wording in the standard, it doesn't seem that you should have an exception for an asset that has a lifetime less than 12 months, that you should treat it differently. I think that's the first point. The other one is was pointed out that the importance, just from a disclosure perspective and presenting this in the financial statements, there is a difference between the loans that are still in line with credit risk at origination versus those that have deteriorated since that point. And I think that's important information for the readers of the financial statements. The other bit that I think is important to point out, I think in some of the ways described in the paper or in the example presented, it almost creates an assumption that even though that the loan has deteriorated, you'd still have the same expected loss. It might still be within a 12-month of a lifetime, but the expected loss of the performing loan compared to a loan that has deteriorated are substantially different, even if both of them have a lifetime that is less than 12 months. And I think you just need to understand there are different the risk perspectives of the performing loan versus the significant deteriorated loan will be different, and even if the performing loan has a lifetime less than 12 months, doesn't necessitate that the deteriorated loan would have a lifetime less than 12 months. So you do need to look at these separately.
Thank you. Okay.
Yes, I would agree with what Paul said. I think it's the reasoning is straightforward, and I agree with that. In addition, I would just mention two things, that there is a strong difference in the calculation of the expected credit loss and the significant deterioration reporting. It's really two things which are strongly different. The thing is that in any case, for me, it would be a normal risk management practice to ensure a regular follow-up of the credit quality. If we do not make this difference, and if we can say that it would not be necessary to have a specific monitoring for significant deterioration, I see somewhere maybe a potential to not consider this kind of strong risk monitoring, which for me is not a good practice. And the second thing is that when a loan will deteriorate, we might see the potential life of the loan increase. And so what is under 12 months at once could not be under 12 months for every time.
Yes.
So only for this kind of reasons, I think it's necessary to keep this consistent.
All right, so what I'd suggest that we have there is then confirmation that the standard is clear, that there's no exception from the general model for short-term assets with a life of less than 12 months. I think your point actually is a useful one, Harvey, to make this distinction that the calculation of expected credit losses and this concept of significant increase in credit risk is two different things, and that therefore the disclosure difference does exist, even whether life is less than 12 months. I think it might also be useful to note that the potential life could change, although it wouldn't change the analysis even if it was going to be less than 12 months. Do we want to make any point about credit risk management and it being consistent with credit risk management? Or
I do.
You do?
I do. Thank you. I'm sure it's no surprise to anyone here. The whole point for us is that the accounting follows the credit risk management, and that we see strong credit risk management flowing right through to the accounting, and I think it's an important point.
People happy with that?
Yeah.
And actually, just going back to the last paper just for a second, I missed one point, and you're meant to be keeping me honest. I didn't mention in my sum up that the point that you all made about selling costs being considered in the calculation, that should be included too, I think, yes?
Do you agree with that?
I think so, yeah. It makes sense. And you all confirmed it, so I thought that was a fair summary.